Coming up on American Parlor Songbook, join us for sketches, stories, and songs from the British colonies. We'll share the Commonwealth with Canadian Jason Kent, Australian songstress Lollies, Brit Jason Fetty, and a tribute to Terry Jones from comedian Stephen Bennequist.
Julie, if we're going to get British about it, we should probably regal it up, you know, get royal.
What, you mean with the intro?
Yeah, give it a little class, you know?
I don't know how to do a British accent, though.
Well, then I'll teach you.
Okay.
Take it from the top.
Coming up.
No. Cooming oop.
On American
British parlor.
Right, okay. On British parlor song.
The parlor is spelled with an O-U, though.
Sorry, you're right. Parlor.
Now turn up your nose.
Oh, okay.
Turn it all the way up. Bring it home.
Join us for tea and trumpets on the record. What's all this, then? At the Royal Jubilee Songbook Parlor, whatever the show's called.
That's perfect.
From the Tudor House Theater in Lake Arrowhead, California, this is American Parlor Songbook with your host at the piano, J.P. Houston.
Hey, thank you, folks. And on the other microphone, she still has to constantly correct my Canadian pronunciation of pasta, or pasta, I don't know, Julie Van Dusen. Britain, the old empire. The colonies, the Commonwealth, the dominions. One queen to rule them all, ceremonially. And she does it all using an almost imperceptible hand wave, because elbow movement is undignified. The last glimmer of an empire that once ruled the world, rolling through a pastoral scene, driving a Range Rover, wearing a tiara. Didn't leave the world unchanged, though. Fish and chips aren't the only thing that survived the retreat. We're all out here speaking it. English, right? Actually, English is German, but we'll get to that later. English is pretty much the international language. Unless Esperanto starts catching on, or there's some kind of Star Trek nerd Klingon uprising. It's going to be the human language, I think, English. But what do I know? I can barely speak it.
Royally speaking, it's fading. Save for the rattling jewels, the empire is adrift and sailing, exiting Europe like fools. Lest we forget all the times we lament when Britain sailed high on the tide of an empire that spread from a rise in the sky high and wide.
Little is known about its original people, the Beakers. We found their pottery, clay beakers, so, well, we just call them Beakers. Makes me wonder if future historians won't dig up one of our landfills somewhere and call our people the Shakeweights. Well, they called them the Beakers. And the Beakers, well, we found their calendar, too, Stonehenge. It was a really big calendar, too big to hang on the fridge, so they put it in a field. As far as I can tell, there were little folks, too. Well, at least they were tall enough to get that top rock onto Stonehenge there, I guess. You know, small droids, though. Hold on, that's Star Wars. Small druids, though, right? Then Celtic speakers started arriving from Europe. The Britons, the Gaels, the Picts. They all carved out their own little pagan slice of the islands there. Oh, look out, here comes the Romans. Well, the Romans came slashing and bashing their way clean up to the Pictish borders, annexing off the Britons into the Roman Empire and creating Britannia. Those oppressive invading maniacs did terrible, horrible things, like improve infrastructure and build roads between towns. Barbaric. Speaking of barbaric, here comes the Saxons and the other Germanic tribes, speaking that funny scrambled up language, Old English. The Vikings even got in on the action. That little tiny set of islands got divided up, conquered, unconquered, reconquered, and split up again 7 ways from Sunday. Tribes became kingdoms, somehow or other. It was England, Wales, Scotland, Ireland. Eventually, I don't know. Check out Wikipedia for details. I'm just a piano player.
Royally speaking, it's fading. Save for the rattling jewels. The empire is adrift and sailing. Exit in Europe like fools. lest we forget all the times we lament when Britain sailed high on the tide of an empire that spread from horizon to sky high and wide.
King James unified the whole shebang. And I think he wrote the Bible and went around putting them in my motel room drawers, too. I don't know. But I do know he did make it all one big kingdom somewhere around the 1600s. All the isles. And so they started sailing out, you know, to spread the jam, as it were, on the toast of the world. The colonies in America, the Caribbean, you know, lots of profitable crops, sugar and tobacco. Get that money and get that power. By the mid-1700s, England was like everywhere. Even Boston. But that didn't last, right? Something about tea in the harbor. They should have at least added a little milk, you know, some common decency. But it held on quite nicely, the empire, and even, at least ceremonially, to this day in some spots. They even held a short French guy off at the borders, with his hand in his shirt, too. He was named after a triple ice cream flavor, I think. And the great nations of Europe casually shook hands and divided up Africa. England got a few nice chunks, but the people revolted in India, there goes another one, and money got tight, the Industrial Revolution shook things up, World War I didn't help, and yeah, they got their crumpets handed to them all around the world, shrinking back like so many chilly swimming pool manhoods into the safety of the islands again, leaving just a few dominions scattered about. Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, most of the Caribbean, some eastern spots, some still have the queen on the money, throwing the proverbial bone to the old monarchy for an easy exit. In Canada, we're still apologizing for it. Sorry.
Royally speaking, it's fading, save for the rattling jewels. The empire is adrift and sailing, exiting Europe like fools. Lest we forget all the times we lament when Britain sailed high on the tide of an empire that spread from horizon to sky high and wide.
Canada is a little like Britain. It's not British, but it's Brit-ish. They kept the U in color and the U in parlor. The Queen's on the dollar. She's the ceremonial head of state, right? She doesn't actually do anything, but then again, neither does Trudeau, I suppose. But mostly, Canada is like America, on skates, with a hint of British culture. A little tea, a little coffee, a bit of howdy y'all, and a bit of what's all this then, with a hint of French lumberjack and a lot of Tim Hortons donuts. Australia was a penal colony. I had to Google the meaning of that one to make sure I don't get an FCC fine. But I digress. Australia, it still has that wild outback spirit, you know? Kind of like warm, noisy Canada. Pretty likable. The Queen still has some extra powers down there, though. She can fire the whole government if she feels like it. Throw those shrimps right on the Barbie. Cliche, I guess. But mostly, you know, they're on their own. New Zealand, Barbados, yeah. It's mostly just a face on a bill and a little pomp and circumstance. Though she does, and this is true, she does have dominion over all the swans in the Thames and the dolphins in the British waters. It's in the law. She has dominion over the dolphins in the British waters. So if you're out sailing, you see a ride past on a porpoise, maybe doing that little hand wave there, salute and bow, give the nice lady that one, the Yankee and greats. It did give us a lot, too, the UK, okay? Some good songs. The Beatles, for crying out loud. I mentioned fish and chips, oh, Monty Python, the telescope, steam power, chemical fertilizer, Shakespeare, not necessarily in that order. So we're going to celebrate it this week, the Empire, for the Commonwealth. Hail to the Queen, count our Canadian ones, and see if we can't revive the Empire. Stick around and put the U in parlor.
Royally speaking, it's fading, save for the rattling jewels. The empire is adrift and sailing, exiting Europe like fools. Lest we forget all the times we lament when Britain sailed high on the tide of an empire. it spread from horizon to sky, high and wide.
The right to print news was tightly controlled in England at the beginning of the 17th century. The Queen's Court, known as the Star Chamber, dictated production until its abolition in 1641. Here to oppress you with a draconian sense of melody, J.P. Houston sings the news.
Now it seems Buckingham Palace is famously cheap for its wage workers. This is true. I read an article about one such job posted for applications. Duties included packing, dressing, drawing bathwater, usual servant stuff, right? One of the ad's adamant points was the need for discretion and trust. All of this for a whopping £14,000 a year, which is like $23,000. Well, sure, that seems like enough to buy discretion. Maybe. So I sent in this musical application of sorts.
Well, my worst trait is likely my focus on detail. That or my moral aversion to blackmail. I'll never be laid or up to tomfoolery. I surely would never abscond with your jewelry. Count on me, I'm honestly a man of constant loyalty. From peasant up to royalty, you can always count on me. Your secrets are safe, Mum. Lean into the flowers. And I never would bring round a bird after hours. Yes, man, I've gone down and drawn up your bath. Soap up your eyes, I'm not pocketing cash. Count on me, I'm honestly a man of constant loyalty. From peasant up to royalty, you can always count on me. Or you never worry, I'll never lie. Sell out a scandal, why would I? You cheap old pants, pitching blue-blooded cow. My trust is only 14,000, so count on me. I'm honestly a man of constant loyalty. From peasant up to royalty, you can always count on me. Look over there, you can always count on me. One of those and one of those. You can always count on me. Back up the truck, boys. You can always count on me.
American Parlor Songbook is now available on PRX, and we're excited to be adding some new stations this season. Well, we're always looking for more ways to subvert the airwaves, so information is available on our website about how to suggest or request a local broadcast. We're also recording live episodes all year, bringing the program and our guests to venues all across Southern California. Our schedule is available online at our website, AmericanParlorSongbook.com.
Antique Treasures heads to the Midwest this week, discovering rare finds from the locals in Sheboygan, Michigan. After his re-election in the summer of 1905, President Teddy Roosevelt braved the Michigan July snow, riding the passive-aggressive express all the way to the top of the Mitten for the ribbon cutting of the region's first fudge shop. The Petoskey Beacon's headline read, "Oh gosh," as the citizens celebrated the only thing that had happened there in the last 5 years. Today, the fudge industry is the number one employer in the region, with the value of the sugary confection outpricing gold per ounce and fatter than ever tourists. Business is booming. So, our experts set up shop at the Northern Michigan Museum of Fudge and invited locals to bring us their antique treasures. First up, don't flinch. That senior citizen holding a wooden spoon isn't here to give you a whack for stealing from the cookie jar. It's Greta von Meister with an interesting story and a potentially valuable piece of spoon history.
All right, Mrs. von Meister, tell us about what you've brought here today.
Well, Roger, this spoon is...
Oh, it's pronounced Roger.
Oh, Roger. This wooden spoon has been in my family since it was given to my grandfather by original fudge meister Helmut von Gehring on the very day that the actual President of the United States, one Mr. Theodore Roosevelt, visited.
Oh, I see.
Yes, the president himself licked this very spoon as the first batch of fudge was being mixed.
If I may, Greta, I'll examine the spoon.
You may not.
I need to establish its provenance.
Well, establish it from there.
Now, let me see it.
Hands to yourself!
Oh, hold on. What's this right here?
That is an antique sales sticker. It's very full of provenance.
From Dollar General.
Because he was a very prominent general in the Civil War.
And the fudge on the spoon, it tastes fresh.
We've been keeping it in the refrigerator.
Mrs. Von Meester, did you just buy this at the dollar store and dip it in fresh fudge?
No, I did not, and I can prove it. Here is a photo of the president himself actually licking the spoon.
Well, that's you in little glasses and a big fake mustache.
No.
Oh, and they didn't have selfies in 1905.
Well, he was ahead of his time.
Do you realize how heavy cameras were in 1905?
He was ahead of his time, and he was very, very strong.
Okay, thank you, Greta. $0 valued
no.
at zero.
No.
Lower that spoon, Mrs. Meester.
Next, a Grand Travis man brings us an interesting piece of folk art.
Now, this looks like an interesting piece. Is this 19th century?
Last Christmas, ongoing.
I see. That is just wonderful. Raw and real. It's an excellent example of American outsider folk art.
Yeah. Every time Grandpa loses a tooth, we put it up there on that plank. Eh?
That's wonderful.
I put the tassels on the end there myself.
Perfect, perfect.
The Christmas lights, they blink if you want them to, and my brother signed this letter to attest to its provenance.
Yeah, you can't say that word enough around here.
Provenance.
I would say this perfect example of American folk art at auction would fetch anywhere in the neighborhood of $70,000 to $80,000.
And it's got teeth?
Easily $80,000. And coincidentally, I will be auctioning it myself on my website, antiqueprovenance.com, after the show, where we absolutely guarantee provenance and certainly don't use this show as a means of overinflating value and profiting on the back end.
And just before the closing bell, this showstopper arrived.
Now this here is a real gem. In all my years in the field, curating on antique treasures, I've only ever seen one like it.
Yes, it is the very spoon that was seen on antique treasures.
Amazing! Valued at $100,000.
Next week, we'll ride the Flint Flasher to Ohio for a show from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, with stunning finds like an original signed Phil Spector arrest warrant and Jerry Garcia's missing finger. Next time on Antique Treasures.
Our very good friend of the program, Jason Fetty, has written an entire collection of songs based on the works of Shakespeare, put it together as a whole theatrical show. Ladies and gentlemen, Jason Fetty.
Thank you very much. Let's have a song by William Shakespeare. It's a word of advice, really, for women. Most of my songs are just complaining about women. So this one fits in really well. Sigh no more, ladies, sigh no more. Men were deceivers, ever one foot in the sea, one on shore. To one thing constant, never, and sigh not so, oh, but let them go, let them go. Be you blithe and bonny, converting all your sounds of woe into a hey. Nonny, nonny, hey, nonny, nonny, sing no more, sing no more ditties, sing no more, dump so dull. since summer first, oh, was leafy. Oh, was I not so? Oh, but let them go. Be you blithe and bonny, converting all your sounds of woe into a hay. Nonny, nonny. Hey, nonny, nonny. You getting this? No. Finally, somebody honest. There's one honest person here in Lake Arrowhead. Everybody else goes, oh, yeah, we get this, absolutely. Mm. Yes. It's William Shakespeare. I'll explain the chorus to you, right? Let's just go through it line by line. It's very simple. He's saying to women, he's talking to women. He says, sigh not so, but let them go. So he's saying, sigh not so, stop whining and let them go. Leave us alone. It's somewhat pre-Freudian, this whole thing. And then he says, and be you blithe and bonny, just be pretty. Shut up, leave us alone, be pretty. It's, I mean, it's not brain surgery, girls. Converting all your sounds of woe, so transforming, converting, changing all of your whining into a hey nonny nonny, which is Shakespearean for, you, I think you get the idea what it's Shakespearean for. It's not FCC approved, put it that way. So next time your husband's bothering you, you say, hey, nonny nonny. It's William Shakespeare, everyone, from Much Ado About Nothing, with a tune by me.
Jason Fetty, how about that? And now from all the way across the other side of the pond and north of here, up in Canada, from Montreal, Quebec, ladies and gentlemen, Sunfields.
The stars behind your eyes are clouds pinned to the sky. Well, tell me how you feel. All the light we cannot see, hidden in the trees and sleeping in the fields. Me in your shell. you say? Oh, how they weigh so heavy on the heart. They're only words like falling birds, like crows upon your tongue. Your love is like a sun, burning everyone and dragging on my heels all the voices in your head, the things you never said, still spinning in the wheel. I wish I
bamboo curtains dangled doorways, worn-out coffee tea or me books balanced bookshelves, and woodblock Picasso prints hung on the walls, where the beatnik ebbed through hippie, into kung fu, through the new age and smack against the edge of the decade, already a decade too late, into the 80s, stuck in the 70s from the 60s, before every house got redone soon, with gold and white and black and Miami Vice. When my mom's oddball friends came over, they usually shuffled us off. You know, things would get a little too groovy probably, so we had to go to the movies or the beach. Oh, so she could talk at the table as crazy as they pleased, artists and poets, and several bona fide lunatics. Not for Pat Donald, though. Now, Pat Donald, he loved us. He was long and slight and as Irish as a field of clovers, with a neat beard and a tailored suit 100 years out of time. A dandy with a pocket watch and a vocal lilt I loved to hear, like a song, up high and melodic. Niagara Falls poured heavy and frothed, a great water wall between north and south, the last stand where Colonel John Butler and his Rangers held off the Yankees to keep Canada British. And the fort still stands, and the Queen still reigns. Oh, Canada, God save the Queen. Even better than Pat Donald's visits, where he'd laugh at all my shenanigans, even better was a visit to his house. His gentle old mother, who he took care of, sat in the chair. Not any chair, but an elaborate oak something or other from who knows when or what. The whole house was like that, a mysterious movie maze. His collection of kid-wowing antiques everywhere, Japanese katana swords, old English urns, ships and bottles, works of art, statues, Buddhas, everything everywhere, all placed just right, but all over the place so you could get lost in it. Underground in a basement somewhere, not far from the falls. Trenches pulled a pin and tossed a flash grenade, storming over the edge into no man's land, or at least to the stairs, to the living room. Trenches was named for his love of, you guessed it, trenches. A love so deep, he dug them in his basement, where he'd get in full war gear and act out the battles. He had to go over the edge into no man's land that night because Trenches was coming over to dinner. Yes. I sat there with nervous knees in anticipation, waiting at the empty dinner table. Pat had his antique gang coming over. Oh, finally, I get to meet these guys, Trenches included. He collected, and the collectors he hung with, well, they were all Indiana Jones types, or maybe even Tony Soprano types. Mikey was the first at the table. He was shifty, like the kind of guy who could arrange to smuggle something out of China for you. Francis was sleek and swift, and he could eye a fake with a looking glass in seconds. And Trenches, well, he ticked away like a nervous time bomb at the other end. And my mom and Mrs. Donald and me. I made it into the fold, and I was going to get to hear the stories. Secret safes behind paintings, gems sewn into taxidermied snakes, and the fakes. Oh, the fakes, the hilarious fakes. When they take some rich sucker for a ride. They told me that they once sold one sucker a pair of handcuffs that they said belonged to Napoleon. They took them away in them, right? Francis just carved them himself, scuffed them up. Trenches formed the paperwork, and Mikey sold him the story. Gold, provenance, they called it. I got excited and piped up. I've got provenance. My great-grandfather was Colonel John Butler, Butler's Rangers. Mikey's ears perked up, and I got swept up in it faster than a flash grenade pop in Trench's basement. Mikey whips out a piece of paper. Here, sign right there at the bottom. Wait, it's blank. Yeah, but just sign there. We'll figure out what it is later. I'm 10 years old. I barely have a signature, but I'm going to go for it. My mom gets up to come around and stop me, but oh, she's too late. I've already signed it. Mikey says, well, we'll figure out something to sell as Colonel John Butler's original something or other later, with a letter of provenance from his great-grandson. My mom reached for the pen, but it was too late. Well, it had already been handed off to Trenches, and he stuck it in his cantina breast pocket. He patted it down. And so, somewhere out there, probably in a house like Pat Donald's, in a maze of dusty old things, there's a musket or a helmet or a vest, something up on a shelf with a framed letter attesting to its authenticity, signed nervously in crayon by a 10-year-old boy.
Jacks with the stars when the world was ours.
APS is on Twitter at Parlor Songbook. And you can find information about the program on our website, AmericanParlorSongbook.com. Now, we love hearing from our listeners, and there's a contact link there on the page. Sometimes I'll even answer your letters in a song on the air. So, if you need advice, or it's your grandmother's 100th birthday, or you just plain want to tell us how much you hate the program, just write J.P. Houston Sings in the subject line, and you never know, you just might get a response on the air. And welcome back to American Parlor Songbook, our episode on the British Empire and the Commonwealth. Now, we've got a piece coming up that was sent in by our good friend, comedian Stephen Benequist. Something a little unexpected, maybe, but interesting nonetheless. Ladies and gentlemen, Stephen Benequist.
And now for something completely depressing. Terry Jones is dead. And he died fading away in dementia at that. So sad that a man with such a brilliant and brilliantly silly mind should witness his own demise. I don't generally dwell on the passing of celebrities in this internet age where an awareness of the doings and passings of the famous are ever present, but I'm feeling this one. Jones and the rest of Monty Python are heroes for me as a comedian. Jones had many accomplishments, but none more famous than being 1/6 of Monty Python, the groundbreaking, absurdist, super smart, but also super silly British comedy supergroup. Supergroup, you ask? Like when rock stars from different famous rock groups come together to form a supergroup? That's pretty much how comedy nerds, and yes, guilty as charged, talk about them. You see, John Cleese was already famous on the 1948 show and other sketch shows and had been collaborating with Graham Chapman since uni days at Cambridge. Meanwhile, Terry Jones and Michael Palin were a writing team who met at Oxford, wrote for numerous shows and created their own, including The Complete and Utter History of Britain and Do Not Adjust Your Set, where they teamed with Eric Idle. Then they all got together, the heavens smiled, the clouds parted, and Terry Gilliam's gigantic animated foot stamped them onto our collective conscience. Monty Python was the first comedy group to really speak to me as a teenager that I thought was mine, even though I was not alive when they originally aired, and I came aboard a generation later when I first saw them they were exciting and different. I felt like I chose them, that their absurdity was special and different and not meant for everybody. They were defiantly obtuse. Their jokes were non sequitur. They asserted their own voice. They were like some exciting band you'd never heard before. A shared appreciation of Python's humor was a sign of a kindred spirit. Oh, you get them too. Obviously, they have legions of fans, and I was far from being some special seeker who alone understood them. But that's what being a teenager is like. And that's what great artists make you feel, a connection. Monty Python's humor was unique and brainy, but their wide appeal demonstrates that their humor was not elite or exclusive. They work on many levels. Yes, their work is strewn with references to Proust and the Spanish Inquisition and farm subsidies, but they also have explosions, pratfalls, and people getting slapped in the face with fish. The particular light that Python turned on over my head, and tons of other students, I'm sure, was that these highly educated men, Cleese was a lawyer, Chapman a doctor, Jones an historian, could still be irrepressibly silly, and that their accumulated knowledge was just more fuel for laughs and creativity. There's probably a graduate thesis to be made here on the post-war push for higher education and the backlash against its inutility in a Cold War-torn world, leading to an outburst of absurdist comedy as the only proper response to a world that made no sense. But you won't see me deliver it without my pasties and burlesque stripper music. Anyway, enough of Python the group. What of Terry Jones in particular? Though he played fools and elites with equal ease, he was neither. Born in the middle of World War II, he was raised middle class, the son of a banker and a homemaker. He was a very intelligent guy with a passion for history, as well as for making people laugh. And like all the other Pythons, he wrote and performed sketches at university, which is where he met Michael Palin, who went on to become his writing partner and lifelong friend. All right, now back to the group, but just for a moment. Now, some comedy sketch shows, most of them, are all about the members trading off starring roles. Who gets to be the weird one? But the Pythons would subvert themselves to the needs of the sketch. They would do all the writing, then cast afterward. Jones, in particular, would often write beautiful parts for others to play, which is a very generous and rare act in the world of comedy. Look up his episode of Monty Python's Personal Best on Netflix if you want to see what I mean. Instead of one weird character, with Python, the whole situation was often weird. To be sure, they had star moments like Eric Idle's Nudge Nudge Sigh No More, Mr. Cheeky character, and John Cleese's Ministry of Silly Walks character. But he had to have Cleese's mile-long legs. It had to be Cleese. But then there were the housewives, the put-upon straight men, the Spanish Inquisition clerics, who were all kind of interchangeable. Jones also had his star moments. He was the naked organ player. He was the lecturer on agricultural subsidies who starts doing a striptease in the middle. And he was the mother of Brian, the man mistaken for the Messiah in the life of Brian, who shouts to a crowd out the window,
"He's not the Messiah! He's a very naughty boy!"
But more often than not, Jones was one of the upper-class twits, one of the falsetto-voiced middle-aged ladies, or pepper pots, one of the Spanish inquisitors. He was a team player, which is part of the charm of Python overall. In interviews, the rest of the group say he was passionate and argumentative, always pushing for how he thought sketches should go. Fitting, then, that he wound up directing all three of Python's films. He co-directed Monty Python and the Holy Grail, the first one with Terry Gilliam, but I digress. He was very concerned that the show and the movies look right and look great, which they did. Gilliam says it was Jones who pushed the group to move on to each new project, keeping them going. And according to Eric Idle, the very idea of what exactly constituted the nature of Monty Python was known only by Terry Jones. If an idea didn't seem to fit his definition, he would protest, "That's not Python!" After Python, Jones co-created Ripping Yarns with Michael Palin, directed several movies, wrote scads of books on history and fairy tales, made some TV programs on history, including the Crusades and the first road maps. He finally used that Oxford degree for something serious, although the shows are pretty funny too. It seems absurd to try and credit any single member of Monty Python with giving it its core essence. It wouldn't be Python without each of them. But the others kind of say it was Jones. two of their three movies are historical epics, and he was the historian. If he leaned hardest on the weirdness, the esoterica, the struggle to mesh comedy with all the learning piled into those six guys' brains at their elite universities, well, you really can't have Monty Python without that, can you? So for what he brought to my favorite sketch group, as a writer, performer, and his esprit de corps, Terry Jones has my deep appreciation. Thank you, Terry, wherever you are. Is that it, then? Eulogy done? All right. Very good. Then, let's get back to work on this one-man show about segregation, seen through the eyes of a whites-only toilet in a gas station in rural Georgia. We'll begin with the history of indoor plumbing, I think. We could go earlier than that, outdoor plumbing, which technically is just a bush. Is that plumbing? Let me get my OED and look up toilette. It's French to begin with, isn't everything? Ah, the French!
Now we've got about time for one more song, so why not another representative of the Commonwealth from Australia, ladies and gentlemen, singer-songwriter Lollies.
And your heart hits a wall, bleeds right there on the floor, so crushing you hear its cry. When no one is there, the ache of despair, it's God you end up talking to. Well, that's enough now, that's enough now, that's enough now. Through the hurt and the the crime and the fate, no one is safe from that. But when the story comes out and you think it is done, goes round and round once again. Well, that's enough now, that's enough now, that's enough. That's enough now. At the end of the end, I don't know what it's all been for. For now I'm young and I'm brave, and I tell myself every day, stay strong, stay whole, when this here's that then. When it hurts, when it burns, call out. When it hurts, when it burns, call out. When it hurts, when it burns, call out. World, that's enough now. That's enough now. That's enough now. Love lets you down, about to break, about to drown, just come back up for air and say, that's enough now, that's enough now, that's enough, that's enough for now. Thank you.
Well, that's our show. Thanks for listening to American Parlor Songbook. APS is produced by the American Parlor Company, presented by KVCR, and available on PRX.
Wendell.
You can find information about the program
Wendell.
On our website, American...
Wendell!
Oh, yes, Ma, they make it quick. I was dreaming of crumpets.
Listen. Listen, Buster, I better be the only crumpet you're dreaming about.
Not strumpet, crumpet, the British treat.
Well, she sounds like a real floozy.
Oh, flaky baked.
Well, maybe if she stopped getting so baked, she wouldn't be so flaky.
Fine, I'll dream of melons.
Keep digging, Wendell.
Oh, food, Martha, food.
Wendell, if you're so hungry, go get a midnight snack.
Dream food is calorie-free.
So is fridge food if you take enough diet pills.
Yes, and then they keep you up all night, interrupting my dream food.
Yes, it's the circle of life. Now, can we talk about what I wanted to talk about?
If it gets me back to my crumpets quicker, all right.
You know, it's funny that you should mention the Brits. That's exactly what I wanted to talk to you about. The royal family.
I am a bit of an expert on the royals, that's true.
Oh, good. Then you can tell me which wig makes me look more like Meghan Markle. Here, look, the middle part or the tied back look here.
They both make you look like an old lady wearing a wig.
I can play in my 30s easy.
Play? Oh. Are you attempting to portray the Duchess?
Portray? No, no. Become? Yes.
Wait, is this a Tonya Harding-esque injury and replacement scheme? Or are we talking about acting here?
Though I do like the sound of the former, I have slightly more experience with the latter.
Slightly.
I'm talking about Netflix.
Oh, brother.
Well, picture it. Coming this summer to Netflix, the ingenue that defines this generation uglies up a little to play a princess.
A duchess.
Oh, no. No, I don't stoop to duchesses. I only play princesses and queens. Maybe a president, if it's got a political angle.
They don't have a president over there, no. It's a prime minister.
Oh, that's not bad. Get me the head shears. I'll do Churchill.
Are you sure you want to go down this road after your last foray to Britain?
It's not my fault that the West End is full of squares.
Well, your turn as a tenacious young dentist who sets out to, quote, unugly a horse-faced population was not well received, Martha.
They heaped praises on me.
Well, they heaped tomatoes on you.
A generous offering of vegetables.
I say tomato, you say tomato.
I say we get the show on the road. I've got a BAFTA to win. I'm working on a begotten.
What's a begotten?
BAFTA. Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, Tony, Nobel Peace Prize.
Of course, your famous acumen as a diplomat, sure.
Wendell, you won't be laughing when I finally reunite us with the Commonwealth.
Wait, you're going to try to take the tea back out of the harbor, are you?
I've been planning it for years. The movie is just phase one. Once they're eating scrumpets out of the palm of my hand, I'll get to work on Brentrance.
Brentrance?
British Entrance. America's coming home, baby.
But why?
So I can fulfill my destiny.
As the woman who undid the Declaration of Independence.
Sure, and the Constitution, which side we drive on, what schedule my blue pills are, or whatever else darn thing that I want.
Because?
Because, as queen, I'll have that kind of authority.
The queen is just a figurehead.
Well, I've got the figure down. And if you'd tell me which wig, I'd have the head as well.
And besides, you have to be born into it.
Oh, I'm working on that.
Being somehow reborn into royalty.
No, forging the documents that prove that I am King George's illegitimate daughter and thus the true heir to the throne.
So, first the wig, then somehow this leads to your coronation.
Why not? Stranger things have happened. Have you seen who's president?
Touché.
Besides, if it falls flat, I still get to play a princess.
Duchess.
And you can write the song for the credits. That's real Oscar bait.
Well, let me know when you've got the funding.
Oh, that's all shored up.
Please tell me you haven't mortgaged the house again, Martha.
No, 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 no. My fans are footing the bill.
Which fans?
Well, the Mongolians, of course.
Oh, I forgot that you're huge in Mongolia.
Yes, all of those late-night movie replays are finally paying off.
Well, you know, I do enjoy a good regal music score, so.
And you are the only one who knows the precise tempo of my walk.
All right, I'll do it, but only if you let me get back to sleep. I'm hungry.
Deal. No,
the pulled back look, it's more royal. Put that one on.
Ah, perfect.
Night-night, then.
Wendell, if you're going to be my prince, you'll have to be a little bit classier than night-night, then.
All right, Rest your weary head, my princess. I bid you a fond adieu.
That's not bad. But it's still missing something.
The bow?
No, the melody.
Oh, right. Okay, how about this?
Martha, the sun has bowed its head. Our friends have all gone home to bed. We've burned the candle end to end. Remember what I've said time and time again. Every evening ends, but you don't need to fret. I'll hold you through the night. Deep sigh, my love, sleep tight. Run out to sea, gently streaming as you dream, right here by me. Martha, the moon is on its way. On pinhole skies, the palm trees sway. Tomorrow is another day. Remember what I say. Though a day will fade, another one is made. Never be afraid, I'll be by your side. Sleep tight, my love. Good night.
Good night.